On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we review where we are with the Juan Soto free agency extravaganza. It seems like we're nearing the finish line with that. Talk about a couple signings, Aroldis Chapman to the Red Sox, Kyle Higashioka to the Rangers, and what he was wearing when he signed that contract. And we have a very special guest, an interview with Joe Davis, the voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and so much more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that Juan Soto should just follow his heart. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Sometimes that's what you got to do, right?
Yeah, I think that is maybe some version of what he is about to do in the coming days as the Juan Soto free agency might be nearing an end. And I got to say, like, I don't want to say, oh, finally, like, no, like, I feel like this has gone exactly as I expected. And I think that he's handled it totally reasonably. And all the fluff and nonsense, like some of the stuff we talked about with our guest Liam Fennessy earlier this week, has nothing to do with Juan Soto. It is just fans and people who are too online following information that is not particularly reliable. So I think for us to be for anybody to be like, oh God, Soto's dragging this out, it's December 5th. Like, no, this is great. I think building this up to kind of a conclusion right before we're at the winter meetings is kind of exactly how one of the biggest free agencies in the sports history should go.
Hot take. It's gone too well. There has not been drama here. And with Judge, we had arson and we had the reporting about the flights to San Diego, and we knew that the Giants were involved, and all of that heightened the intensity around the moment. And then last year with Ohtani, we had the flight to Toronto. Now, look, is the Soto situation being handled more professionally so far? Yes. Is that good entertainment for me? A selfish dum-dum? No. So I need one twist in the tail here.
Yeah. I think that's fine. I don't totally disagree with that. Remember the Judge walking into the San Francisco hotel and being like, oh, hey, oh, can't believe you caught me here. that was so goofy. But to me, the fun of this one, while I agree with you that like the drama and the goofy storylines or like twists haven't quite happened, the uncertainty here is still tremendously compelling in a way that we didn't really have with Judge or Ohtani, even with the flight to Toronto and even with arson Judge, in my opinion.
That is true. Judge was trying to squeeze that last year out of the Yankees by any means necessary, which is why he was a little showy there at the end. Doesn't feel like Soto is going to have to do that. And we're going to start today's show with the opener. Which is, of course, about Juan Soto. Where are we at? What is the lay of the land right now, Thursday, December 5th at 9:25 a.m. Jordan Schusterman.
I feel like I am very glad we are doing a podcast on Thursday instead of Friday, because this is a situation where I feel like every hour brings us closer to the news we have all been waiting for. And that is what the reporting that has come from the likes of Jeff Passan, from Alden Gonzalez, from John Heyman, all the people following this as closely as they have that have been given us fairly reliable reports over the last few weeks seem to suggest that. And now Jeff Passan going on SportsCenter and saying that he thinks it's likely to be a decision that we will know before the start of the winter meetings. I think that is at least a little bit of a crumb that I don't think Jeff would say by accident. However, I still think we're in a state of feeling like it is coming. We do not know exactly when, but Scott Boras being asked about this at Blake Snell's presser earlier this week and him basically being like, he's begun the process of eliminating teams. We have not yet heard anything reliable saying this team has been told they are out. When we are sitting here on Thursday morning, that is not something we have heard yet. And it's possible we won't until it's all over. But there's also versions of these big free agencies where you start hearing leaks from teams saying like, oh yeah, they told us, okay, he's narrowed it down. And we still have not gotten that far, even though Scott Boras did say he's begun the process of eliminating teams.
What is notable is we know what teams he will now be eliminating and who has not made an offer. And I want to start there because there was a lot of buzz about the Phillies at one point and about the Nationals, just because that's where Soto started his career. Matt Gelb of The Athletic reporting yesterday that the Phillies never made an offer to Soto. I mean, that's not particularly surprising. Their payroll is already supersonic and they don't, everyone could use Juan Soto. Duh. He makes the least amount of sense for all of these big competitive teams right now, in my opinion. So it's not particularly shocking. Then for the Nationals, I have to say I am surprised that we've heard nothing about the Nationals. Not even like in a 11th hour, oh, they made a late offer. It could still happen. It doesn't feel like it's going to. And that's interesting to me, considering the relationships Soto still has with people who are with the Nationals. So I think it is fair for Nats fans to be a little bit disappointed that there's not even going to be a We Tried banner.
Hey, not to mention, and maybe people listen to this, hey, you guys are talking about him too much, but not to mention the relationship Boras has with the Nationals owners and just Nationals organization. I mean, we talked about the last year, you know, when the Nationals drafted Dylan Cruz and Scott Boras was like, you know, emotional at the Dylan Cruz press conference, just like thinking about all of the things that he's been involved in with that organization. Like, that is a real thing that I there's no reason to believe that that has necessarily dissipated. Now, we know that the Lerner ownership group has not necessarily spent in the same ways recently, and maybe they aren't ready to do that right now. But I am also surprised and officially ready to move them aside. I know I've been holding out for the longest thinking the Nats were going to get into this, but we are still talking about these five teams: the Yankees, the Mets, the Red Sox, the Blue Jays, and the Dodgers, by all accounts, are at least still in this in some form. As we approach the finish line, there's a good chance you will not hear from us again until after we know where Juan Soto is signing. Have you changed anything, any feeling about this? Because we have not gotten any reported clarity that it is actually leaning in any sort of way, despite what people like Liam Fennessy are tweeting.
I find it very hard to believe that he will be a Dodger or a Blue Jay, because the Dodger MO is to go short years, high money. They did this with Bryce Harper. And I don't think, I just, again, they're Dodgers. They could surprise us. They've done that before. I just think it really does come down to those three teams, the Yankees, the Mets, and the Red Sox. I have fluctuated between Mets and Yankees all offseason, and I'm going to make my final pick will be the Mets. I think that Steve Cohen is just going to drop a Brinks truck on him that the Yankees ownership group can't compete with.
I think I agree. I guess I'll ride it out with you with the Mets. I think the last question in this Soto conversation is what number are we going to end up at? Okay, there was support. Oh, the bidding has reached $600 million. Yeah, like, to me, that's not news. If it hadn't, I would be stunned. You know, if it was like, what are we doing? I think the question now is, we know it's going to smash the present day value of Ohtani. That was true, you know, on, you know, November 1st. I mean, what I think would be very funny is if we end up with a $701 million deal. That would be the most Boras move we could see. And then also, how many years are we talking? I think it's probably more likely that we see 15 years than we see $700 million. Now, those might go hand in hand, depending on the AAV. But that's what I think. I think we're just going to end up seeing definitely the longest free agent contract ever. Will it actually be $700 million present value, or at least will the numbers start with seven? I think at this point, it's in play.
15 times 46.75. is 701.25.
And oh, is it really exactly?
So if he gets 46.
Okay. Yeah.
0.75 per year for 15 years, I mean, he'll pass Ohtani in present day value. I mean, he's passing Ohtani in present day value no matter what, right? Like the deferrals on the Ohtani contract
bring
headline. That number
It's down. The headline.
It's the headline.
Will the headline say 701 million or more?
Yes.
At this point, I feel like the answer is yes. Now, the last part about this, and I've mentioned this along the way of the last few weeks that I am curious about, we have not contemplated the kinds of opt-outs that could be involved here, which I do think is relevant for a player this young. Like, I mean, again, when Gerrit Cole signed his massive contract, you know, with opt-outs, we weren't thinking about opt-outs, and then suddenly we were, and then suddenly we weren't, right?
The best example but here,
I do think
the
that
best
it's,
example
it's, yeah.
is that yeah. Manny Machado and Bryce Harper signed enormous contracts yep. in the same winter, mm-hmm. both with Scott Boras. Or excuse me, Machado is not Boras.
Machado's not Boras. Yep.
Machado's contract had an opt-out in it. Harper's did not. And as a result, Machado threatened to opt out with the Padres and got a even bigger, newer contract. And at the end of both of their contracts, Machado will have made pretty significantly more money than Harper, which is surprising when you look at the production. You would say Bryce Harper is a better baseball player and has, you know, produced more. But because of the opt-out that Machado had, he had a lot of leverage, and Harper didn't do that. And we saw last winter where Harper was like trying to angle with the Phillies, hey, can I get a new deal? They're like, no, you don't have any opt-outs. Like, you have no leverage. So I think you're right, but it isn't, it's going to come down to like, does he want the headline with a seven or does he want the opt-outs? Because I don't think he can get both. I really don't. Yep. Because if you're going to commit that amount of money, I think a team might be skeptical to throw the opt-out in there.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I hadn't thought about it as an either or, but yeah, I just think that like the actual structure of the contract, not deferrals, that does not interest me as much anymore. I'm sure they will be involved in some form almost no matter what. But the opt-out part of it and when those could be for someone signing this young is, I think, compelling to me. But that's where we're at. And I really do feel like we will know before we speak again, which will be, of course, going into the winter meetings. We are flying to Dallas on Sunday. Of course, we are doing just the two shows this week, so it'll just be this Thursday show. So we'll see, of course, as soon as he signs. If he signs on Friday, we'll hop back on the mics as soon as possible. But it seems like we are nearing a finish line here, and I think this has gone exactly as I was kind of hoping at the start of the offseason, and I can't wait to find out the answer. This should be fun.
All right. Let's swing around the league because not everything revolves through Juan Soto. Well, actually, it kind of does. We had two signings. We'll talk about Kyle Higashioka's landmark deal with the Texas Rangers in a little bit to be their backup catcher. But let's begin with Aroldis Chapman. 1 year, $10.75 yes. million to sign with the Boston Red Sox.
So Boston, I think we know, has been active and they're part of the Soto conversation. And we kind of talked to Liam earlier this week. All right, well, the Red Sox, it can't just be Soto. They have to be working on other things. We know that they need pitching arguably more than they need Soto. We understand why they're going after Soto. And with a number of their, you know, 2024 relievers hitting the free agent market, we knew that they were going to be kind of going after some amount of impact bullpen arm. However, Aroldis Chapman is certainly not the one that I know a lot of fans wanted to see. This is not a person or character that many people are interested in rooting for at this point in his career for numerous reasons, both on and off the field. Of course, chief among them, the domestic violence suspension, the first suspension under the current domestic violence policy in MLB was the one that Aroldis Chapman received back earlier in his career. Of course, the details surrounding that are horrific, and you know, we've talked about them on the show before. And obviously, when you have situations like that and you have players like that who make extremely disturbing off the field decisions that sure get punished in some form, and that he, you know, missed the games at the time but is still been able to continue his career, it puts fans in a very difficult position, because as we've seen with Chapman, as we've seen with some other people who have been suspended, teams are going to keep giving these guys chances, and that is a really frustrating and disheartening thing for a lot of fans. And I completely understand that. I mean there's really no way around that. And I think Chapman, you know, it's interesting just because since he's been on the Yankees, he's been playing in Kansas City and in Pittsburgh. And by the way, let's be clear, it's not like there weren't fans that were uncomfortable there too, right? Texas as well. But when you end up in a bigger market again, like Boston, it's going to be another kind of round, justifiably so, of questioning how, you know, you can make a commitment to someone like this and have this be a big part of your baseball strategy, even though obviously GMs have told us at this point that they're still comfortable signing him.
It's really simple to me. If you're a fan of the team, do you want to go to the yard and root for this guy? No. You want to root for the team, and his success and the team's success are obviously intertwined, but you do, like, in comes Aroldis Chapman out of the bullpen, you're four beers deep at Fenway Park, you don't want to get up and root your head off for him. And so that just, like you said, puts fans in a really weird situation. From a baseball perspective, if you look at his numbers last year when he was with Pittsburgh, they're not great. The underlying stuff is a lot better, which is always the case with Aroldis Chapman because he throws 1,000 miles an hour and strikes out a lot of people. That being said, for me, do you trust Aroldis Chapman in a playoff game in a high leverage spot at this point in his career? Absolutely freaking not. No way. No chance. No, I'd like, he's a walk machine. Still, yeah. Are the Red Sox hoping he's that he's good for?
There's no one
he's
else.
The original walk machine, and so yeah, I struggle to. It's so weird that the Red Sox are saying to their fans, like, we're gonna do it, we're gonna go for it, and their first move is signing Aroldis Chapman. It's just to me, if they had done this after signing Juan Soto, it would have played differently to the fan base probably. But doing it now, it conveys a lack of feel.
But yeah. Well, which is interesting because we understand that generally front offices are not operating with PR in mind. That isn't technically part of their job description. But for the Red Sox in particular, I think it is. I think it should be. And of course, we would love to believe that it should play a role for all 30 teams and that, you know, people who make mistakes like this, you know, should not necessarily get these second chances. And I totally understand that opinion. I think that's valid. But Chapman in particular, because of how volatile he also is on the field, the truth of the matter is he's still one of the hardest throwing left-handers in the league. He's still striking out the world. He's still walking the world, but he's still effective enough. And as long as he's eligible. And the other thing is, like, for as catastrophic of an end of his tenure was with the Yankees, people, clearly teams are believing that he is still some sort of a good teammate, right, in the clubhouse, right? We are not commenting on the quality of the human being off the field, the mistakes he's made off the field, but clearly there's a reason that teams want to keep signing him, but that doesn't make it any easier for the fans. And so that is why, for the Red Sox in particular, this timing is disappointing. Again, we knew Aroldis Chapman was going to sign somewhere this winter, and that's probably going to keep happening as long as he's throwing 100 miles an hour with his left arm. But that's, in this case in particular, was a little surprising, and now, you know, puts him in a bullpen with Liam Hendricks, who's coming back and is strangely the other side of the spectrum of who doesn't love Liam Hendricks, right? So now you have this very strange back of the bullpen where you have Liam Hendricks, you know, coming back from injury. But that's another thing. Just there's still a lot of unexpected things. If we're just strictly looking at the bullpen depth chart and thinking, like, okay, how good are the Red Sox going to be? I don't know what Liam Hendricks is going to be. I mean, it's been a while. We know what he's been through off the field with injuries, with cancer. I mean, what a story for him. And we're rooting for him. But, I mean, these guys are 36, 37 years old. And this is, if this is your back of the bullpen, I can't say I'm feeling awesome about it, right? I hope Liam Hendricks comes back as awesome. But I think there's still work to be done here for this Boston pitching staff for sure.
Enough of Chapman. Anything else around the league you want to talk about before we take a break?
Yeah, the one thing I just wanted to hit on quickly, because I don't think we've said his name at all, is the fact that Korean second baseman Hye-Sung Kim is officially being posted. This is a player who does not necessarily carry the same kind of star level reputation that Hye-Sung Kim did when he came over and had been one of the best players in Korea for a long time. But this is still a free agency that is certainly worth monitoring, because this is someone who is going to turn, 26 in January. And so, as we've talked about with Soto, obviously it's a different player and a different talent level. You don't have opportunity, and we've talked about with Sasaki, you don't have opportunities to sign free agents this young. And even if he's like a good utility player or like a second base, just like a really, really good defensive second baseman who could put the ball in play and steal a bunch of bags, like that's kind of the profile we're talking about. We're not necessarily talking about a big, impactful bat. But like that kind of player is still super valuable to get as a free agent. And so this is a guy that could end up on a lot of different teams that can probably afford him that could, you know, be an interesting addition and is not really someone we've addressed. And because he's making that move, we can expect him, you know, to sign here in the next month or so. I believe the deadline will be January 3rd. So hi, Sun Kim. We have not really mentioned him at all, but he is someone I don't know. I know we didn't rank him on our top 50 free agents. I know some other lists did have him on the top 50. So he's going to get probably a multi-year deal. And it'll be interesting to see how his bat translates, because the reality is that KBO pitching right now is very, very, very bad. So it's very difficult to project how good he is going to actually be as a hitter. And it's not like his offensive numbers were amazing, but you know, always hit for a high average, really fast, excellent defender. And if he can play shortstop, I think there are going to be some teams that are really interested in him. So just wanted to mention Hi Sung Kim officially posted for MLB teams.
He's going to confuse a lot of old white dudes with Ha Sung Kim. That's going to be a tough break for those guys, but you know, they'll be okay.
Yeah.
One more thing before we go to our interview with Joe Davis, which I guess we haven't mentioned so far on this podcast. That's coming. That'll be pretty rad. The Yankees reportedly met with Max Fried and Corbin Burns. This is via Joel Sherman of the New York Post. This makes sense. This is the Soto pivot. This is the break in case of your right fielder generational slugger from last year going to Queens. And it's interesting considering how many arms the Yankees already have on the roster, but you can never have too much starting pitching. You really can't. And you could see a scenario where they eat some money and they try to trade someone else away. And if you get Max Fried or Corbin Burns, like that makes your team better. It's not that complicated. That being said, none of that is going to move, in my opinion, until we get Soto. So just throw that in your back pocket and know that it happened.
Well said. Let's get to that interview that you mentioned that we haven't mentioned. That's true. You see it in the title of this podcast, though. And you know that we are about to talk to Joe Davis, the voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers, the voice of more than just the Los Angeles Dodgers. As we know, he has become one of the bigger broadcasters in all of sports, not just baseball. And Joe joined us a few days ago. We pre-recorded this conversation and talked to us about the season that was and calling 50-50 for Ohtani and calling the World Series. And then also, what my favorite part of the conversation is just, you know, where does Joe Davis come from? How did this all start for a guy who's, you know, still in his mid-30s and is now, you know, at the top of the broadcasting world almost? So we had a really good conversation with Joe. We hope you enjoy it. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we will talk to Joe Davis, voice of the Dodgers, and many other things. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very lucky to be joined by a special guest. His name is Joe Davis. You may have heard of him. Joe, welcome to Baseball Barbacast, your Barbacast debut.
Hi, Jordan. Hi, Jake. How you guys doing?
We're doing splendidly. Good. I am curious. The first thing I'm going to ask you is, what is the percentage breakdown of you getting recognized by face and by voice?
Very small percentage for both. I don't get recognized. I do it like out of context. It doesn't happen a ton at the stadium. It happens a lot. It's probably, I don't know, probably 90-10 face, but it does happen occasionally where somebody like do a double take. Actually, my daughter and I were getting ice cream a few months ago and the worker was down scooping the ice cream, like head down in it. And then she like popped up when she heard me say something to my daughter and like, wait a minute. So that would be a voice example. It does happen.
So you are the voice of many things in our sports consuming life. Obviously, this is a baseball podcast, so we are going to steer mostly clear of your NFL responsibilities and focus on your job as the voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers, the World Series champion Los Angeles Dodgers, and just the postseason and the big games that we love to watch over these last few years. And I think that the second half of this conversation, we kind of want to zoom a lot farther backwards to where this all began for you, but But let's zoom in on this Dodgers team, because they did just win the World Series and you've been calling their games for quite some time. You've watched the Dodgers win so many baseball games since you started doing this job, and yet they have not won the last one since you've, of course, been doing the World Series. I know 2020, you were not doing World Series games yet. But what made this Dodgers team different? I know it's a pretty cliche question that they ask the players in the wake of it, but I'm curious from the broadcaster perspective of someone who has called so many of these games, did you have a sense at some point during the regular season when it was like, you know what, this understanding that the postseason is random, did it feel different at any point this season?
I would say, and I haven't put a ton of thought into this actually, I think that it started to feel different for me once they got down 2-1 to the Padres in the division series, and you saw the way that they responded. Like Kike Hernandez had that interview after game five where he dropped an F-bomb on national TV, and like, not a great look, like, come on, Kike. But I think there's something to what he said. It wasn't just like a moment where he was trying to be ridiculous. I think there was something to what he said where this group just had kind of an edge to it that previous years might not have. And the way Dave Roberts put it to us as the postseason went on was, this group learned how to street fight. This group learned how to brawl. And anytime, that was the best example, where they're right on the brink of the whole thing ending, but anytime things started to stack against them, whether it was having to come back to LA in the championship series to play game six after they got routed with the chance to finish off the Mets, or the Yankees taking that 5-0 lead in game five, they just didn't care. And it was a personality trait to the team as a whole that was different.
And I think you touched on something interesting there, which is it's hard to be sturdy in that way if you don't face adversity.
Yeah.
Right. You can't just show up and win 118 games and have nothing go wrong and say that you're gritty.
Yep.
Right. Yep. You have to actually battle something. And they certainly did do that with all the pitching injuries. Speaking of pitching injuries, I want to talk about Shohei Ohtani, which is one heck of a transition. I am most specifically intrigued about the 50-50 day in Miami. So you wake up that morning and you're on this series, and you know that he's on the brink of history, but you don't necessarily know he's going to get there that particular day. So right. I'm curious, walk me through your experience of being at Lone Depot Park in Miami and witnessing and carrying the responsibility of what Ohtani was there to accomplish.
All right, so even more so than I don't know if he's going to do it, I obviously don't think he's going to do it. And that's a big deal, because this is a Thursday. After that game, I fly to New Orleans to do the NFL for the weekend. If he doesn't miraculously pull it off here, I'm probably selfishly bumming that I'm not going to get to call it. So the chances that he does it, he needs a stolen base and two home runs that day, very small. So I go into the day, truthfully, like, this sucks. You know, like, maybe because they're going to play the Rockies that weekend. Of course you're going to hit seven home runs against the Rockies, but maybe the Rockies pitch around him or something. So I went into the day secretly, selfishly, hoping he did nothing, to keep right at 48 home runs and then think maybe he gets just one against the Rockies this weekend. I come back next week, Padres are in town, and then it happens. That's my only chance to get to be on the call for this. And then we all know how it winds up happening. And
instead of doing nothing, he does everything.
Yeah, and it's a getaway day in Miami on an afternoon. Like, it's not exactly where you expect greatness to be conjured, but yet such is Shohei Ohtani.
Man, and to your point, Jordan, it was like, it wasn't just let's go ahead and get there and achieve history. The amazing thing about the day, one of the amazing things about the day, is that this would have been one of the greatest days ever, no matter if it was April 5th or June 1st or hitting 50-50. In a vacuum, it's one of the greatest games anybody's ever played. I mean, only like I really don't know if the guy's human. I think he was sent here by the baseball gods to break the game.
So how did your perspective on him change by being around it in person, by witnessing the unicorn that is Shohei Ohtani? Because I'm sure you had expectations.
or at least half of it.
I just don't know if it's possible to have a full appreciation for them until you watch them every day. Because I like you guys, am such a huge baseball fan and had watched him from afar and, of course, appreciated him. But to really know how different he is to watch the Tuesday night foul ball and to watch the infield single on a Sunday afternoon. Like, to see all those things that stack up, similar to, like, a role player where, you know, you say you got to watch him every day to see his value. On the other end of the spectrum is the greatest player ever to play, and I think it's similar. You have to see it every day to see those little pops, those little flashes where it's like, oh, my God, he's different than everybody. We all see that from afar, but when you're there every day, that's when it becomes jaw-dropping, seeing those things happen every single day, day after day.
One more Ohtani thing, and then we'll spin it back to the postseason. How many times this year were you like, man, this guy also pitches? because you haven't seen that. I mean, you've seen it.
Right.
I mean, he's been in the league, and I'm sure you've called him. I don't know if you've called him pitching against the Dodgers since he's been here or not, but either way, you've seen it, but you haven't seen it like this. Was there a point or I mean, that's what's so amazing about his season. We weren't thinking about his pitching, that it was so good that we didn't have to think about it.
Of course, we chatted about it like it would come up, but no, I don't remember really thinking about it. We were so absorbed by what we were watching at the plate. Like, how could it possibly be any better than this? We didn't think about it. We didn't talk about it a whole lot.
Right. That's great, because then you have this whole new thing for next season. He pitches too. Just to spin it back to October, are there any moments from that run that stand out in your mind as either defining for the team or as abnormal, or ones that you think will stick with you for the rest of your career and the rest of your life and the rest of your baseball fandom? And could you see Dave Roberts's energy changing over the course of the postseason? Like, he started to become more confident in where it was going to end up?
Yeah, I think he had a clarity and a conviction to him throughout this postseason that he has said that he didn't quite have. Not that he was lacking those things. He just really felt strongly and in control of every moment. And during the sit downs before the games, where we'd sit down with him as the Fox crew, I remember sitting there thinking before game four of the division series, this may be the last time that I sit down with him as the manager of the Dodgers. Right? It was looking like they were going to lose that series. And he's talked about it. He knew there was a chance that, right or wrong, fair or not, that was going to be it for him if they did have another early exit. So sitting there from that day in San Diego thinking like, man, where he was resolute at that point. There still was I remember
always honest, always
awesome. And knowing that's why it was so made such an impression when we came out of there saying like, he still thinks they got his, like John Smoltz saying, I'm ready to run through a wall after sitting down with him. You know, you felt like you were in this tense pressure cooker, like foxhole, sitting in there in those meetings, no matter if I'm the Dodger guy or not. You know, like you get pulled into this when you're in this intimate setting, no matter who the manager is, no matter what team it is. And seeing from there to getting through that, and the way that, you know, from his perspective, things snowballed from that edge we were talking about that the team had this year that they maybe didn't have in recent years. Seeing that play throughout the postseason, yeah, you definitely saw that evolve through October.
From that to Dancing with Ice Cube, what a world.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was something, but that was really cool for a guy who, you know, that's who he is, right?
And, yeah, man.
And like with any athlete, they're people before they're players. With any manager, they're people before they're managers. And to get to see the person come out a little bit there after the pressure cooker that he's lived and the criticism that he's taken through the years, that was I never thought Dave Roberts grinding on Ice Cube would be something that I would see, let alone something that I would enjoy seeing. But here we are.
So my last postseason related question is the fifth inning of game five, because we talk about We talked about 50-50 and how you weren't sure if you were going to have the opportunity to call that. And even in that very game, you didn't weren't sure you were going to have the opportunity to call that. Yeah. And what you just described with Dave Roberts, how you're sitting there earlier in the postseason, oh, where is this going? Where is the story going? This game five, yes, the Dodgers still had a commanding series lead, but that game itself also felt like it was heading in a very different direction. Now, we were fortunate enough to be in the building to watch it unfold without, obviously, we watched your calls after the fact, and we kind of heard the incredulity, as with everyone else that was watching, what was happening. But kind of take me through that game five of feeling like, okay, oh my God, are we going back to Los Angeles to then watching an inning that will be remembered for a very, very long time in just a kind of baseball that you also mentioned, 50-50, that day was something that would have been incredible in any context. That inning would have also been incredible in any context, but of course it was the biggest context. So the swings for you as someone trying to call this game properly, what was that like?
Going into the fifth inning of game five, I was more organizing in my head, okay, what's it going to mean if Gerrit Cole throws a no-hitter here? Because remember, it was not Yankees five, Dodgers nothing, maybe headed for game six. It was, oh my gosh, Gerrit Cole's about to pull Don Larsen here in a game five, not perfect game, but a game five World Series no-hitter against the Dodgers. So all those things are going through my head, and it's while I'm organizing those thoughts that this all unfolds. It goes from looking like a possible no-hitter, a sure thing trip back for a game six where all bets are off at that point, to what we know happened, which is a complete all-time, given the context, Jordan, to your point, World Series meltdown. I mean, it is a longer reel, but it's the ball getting by Buckner. It's historic. In the same way Freddie Freeman's Game 1 Grand Slam probably is a top five moment in World Series history, and that's something that I talk with buddies about that. You know, we'll have a cocktail, and the conversation will come up like, you know, is that the greatest moment? No, but like, I have a hard time even wrapping my mind around where that falls, and I think it may take me months or maybe years to fully appreciate what it was. It's the same thing with that fifth inning on the other end of the spectrum, all-time bad World Series innings. It's got to be up there near the very top of the list.
I want to ask about Freddie, and then we'll ask you about Beloit.
Naturally.
Naturally, as one does.
Yeah. So, as we do.
As we true. Do. Freddie Freeman walk-off Grand Slam. It sounds like a joke when you say it.
Yeah.
It was so impossible that it felt like a bit. I am curious for you, in that moment, what does that moment mean to you now in the short term looking back at it? Because to me, it is the perfect example of how a broadcaster can elevate a moment, can take a moment that already has so much to it, and can turn it into something that we remember forever. And so just personally, as someone who loves the sport, thank you. No. And I know you're going to tell me that you couldn't have done it without Freddie Freeman, which is obviously true. But when you look at that moment, what does it mean to you right now? And how do you anticipate that changes as your career goes on?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I still can't fully wrap my mind around it, I don't think, the significance of it. Just from a personal standpoint, you grow up dreaming of doing this job. And when you grow up dreaming of doing this job, that's the moment you grow up fantasizing of happening. And in the same way, and I talked to Freddie about this, in the same way he grew up thinking World Series, walk-off home run, like game on the line, I grew up thinking of being in that chair when that happened and having an opportunity to make the call. It still doesn't seem real. I think probably because the thread for me does go back to childhood. Like that is a moment that I sort of had happened many times in my head. And now it actually happened and it really happened. There's something going on up here where it just doesn't quite compute. And I mentioned a little bit ago, like it may take me months to fully appreciate what that moment means in baseball history. Same thing for what it means to me personally. Just to have been in that chair when that happened, and how that's kind of a culmination of a lot of dreaming and hoping and praying and working
and hard work.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a lot of things. That's a loaded answer, Jake. But hopefully you can tell I've thought a lot about it, and it's a heavy thing for me because it's pretty deep.
But yeah. zooming out further, I think now we kind of want to finish with you on where it kind of began, because I think when you describe that dream and you describe thinking of calling those moments, the first thing I think of is, okay, when does that start? But the other thing I think of is that, Joe, you're calling a lot of other sports. And so the specific walk-off Grand Slam World Series is almost too good to be true. I mean, maybe that it was specifically what you were thinking, but either way, it's almost beyond what you could even dream up. But I'm curious, and maybe it wasn't baseball, maybe it was, when those dreams start, you know, baseball has, was that the first one? I know you were doing football in college back in Beloit, Wisconsin, and we can talk about your D3 roots that we can, of course, appreciate as much as anybody. But was it baseball? Were you fantasizing, thinking about calling buzzer beaters or game-winning touchdowns? Like, I'm sure they were all in there, but where was the walk-off in those early, you know, dreams?
I've said a few times, Jordan, that it was all those, to your point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, you know, the Final Four winning three-pointer. It was the game-winning touchdown. It was all those things. But if you would ask me, pick one game, it always would have been, the answer was Game 7 of the World Series. Mm-hmm. I haven't had that yet. But it's just preposterous that I'm doing what I'm doing. It's like I've said to a few people, it's not like somebody who says, I want to get into politics and then gets to become a senator or whatever. Amazing, incredible. It's like somebody who says, I'm going to be president. I'm like, okay, kid. I said, I want to call big games and the buzzer beater. And they're like, I want to call Game 7 of the World Series. I want to be Joe Buck. And to be the guy that somehow one day winds up following Joe at Fox, it really is just, it's stupid. I say with like the Freddie Freeman thing, I'm wrapping my mind around what that is, but it's my whole friggin' life. And I don't know, guys. I don't know.
I mean, it flashes before I could imagine, like in the moment, like you're in the car on the way home from the stadium.
Yeah.
And you're seeing Beloit, you're seeing Montgomery, Alabama, you're seeing all these different stops along the way.
Right.
And I wanted to, we had a kid on a couple of weeks ago named Caleb Durbin, who is in AAA with the Yankees, just got added to the 40-man D3 player, who went to Wash U where I went, and so I have a connection with him. And he spoke about the need to have almost an irrational confidence in himself to beat the odds of where his career started. And I look at you and, you know, Beloit College is not somewhere that broadcasters come from, right? And so when you're in college doing games at the D3 level, something that Jordan and I have certainly experienced, when does it go from a dream to a reality to you? Or was this something that you always genuinely believed was inside of you?
Yeah, I think it was always... always both those things, and still is. Yeah. Like, I'm still living a dream here, but it was always both those things. It was a dream, but it was going to happen. I don't know if I was going to become the World Series guy, but I was going to do this job, and I was going to find a way to be successful at it. So much is out of your control. I figured Joe would be at Fox forever, and you know, who knows where my path would lead, but so many things have to break your way. But to answer your question, Jake, I think that it was never not serious. And that's kind of how I'm wired. Like if you watch my 6-year-old son run around the house now, it's the same deal, just it's not worn great by a 6-year-old where everything is like the biggest thing. And if you're going to do it, you're going to do it and you're going to obsess over it. That's kind of how I've always been. So as soon as I decided this is what I wanted to do, it wasn't like, oh, that'd be cool. It was, no, let's go make it happen.
My last question for you is very simple. Did you ever call a game at Joe Davis Stadium?
Oh, yeah.
In Huntsville, Alabama?
Yeah. Yeah. And that place was a dump.
We've been there.
Oh, yeah.
You guys been there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Dump of all dumps, But I remember pulling up. So this would have been 2010 through 2012 when I was doing Montgomery Biscuit games, and pulling up the first series there on the team bus, and our veteran catcher, his name is Nevin Ashley. I don't know if you guys mm-hmm. ever crossed paths mm-hmm. with him, but he's sitting up near the front. I'm kind of in the middle of the bus, and we pull up, and you know, there's cobwebs everywhere and broken glass laying everywhere. And this place is just concrete jungle. And he turns around, he looks at me, and he says, "Nice stadium, Joe." So, I always remember that about my trip there. But man, oh man, it was a dump, and there'd be like seven people there. Terrible.
Yes. Yes. And this is why we had to ask, because we first visited Joe Davis Stadium, which is now like a soccer stadium, no longer hosting baseball. But that because we remembered it was one of the worst minor league places we've been to, we were like, that was our association with the name Joe Davis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we learned about you.
Yeah. Yeah. We're like, this guy's got stuck.
And then you showed up and we're like, we know that's a different person, but that is still, it took a while yeah. before we were like, oh, Joe Davis, Huntsville. But that's where my final question is, before we let you go. And Jake sort of hinted at those moments, because part of what's amazing to me about your short story is that this all happened very fast. Yeah. Joe, you're the same age as Clayton Kershaw. You haven't been doing this that long, okay? Like, it's not like this was that long ago that we're talking about. So wow. Is there one thing? Is it Joe Davis Stadium? Is it, you know, something in the Midwest Conference basketball where when you are driving home from the Freddie Freeman Grand Slam, you're thinking like, man, I was doing that not that long ago? Because we, in our silly job that we're fortunate enough to do, have moments like that, and we're so lucky. I can imagine for you it's times a million.
Yeah, there are a lot of those things. I think that it's not one particular moment or game. It's just kind of a collage of those things, probably Montgomery related, you know, minor league baseball related, whether it's doing a game at an empty Joe Davis Stadium, or it's riding the bus 9 hours through the night, or, you know, just a lot of those images, those snapshots throughout my time in the minor leagues, and trying to get my first chances on TV at ESPN3 and CSS and CSTV and those places down in the Southeast. And my first game, not my first game, but the Pensacola Blue Wahoos, they opened mm-hmm. their stadium 2011 or 12, I think mm-hmm. 2012, my last year in Montgomery, opening day. We were down there for the opening of that stadium, and we walked into the booth, and we knew that they're getting the stadium ready, like last minute, going to have it ready for opening day. We walk into the booth, and there's a technician in our booth laying down on the ground up under the table, sort of working on plugs and phone lines and stuff. And I'm like, well, this is not great. You know, we're 4 hours away from needing that phone line to be pretty dialed in here. Turns out they didn't have the phone lines ready. And to do a radio broadcast back then required the phone line. That's how you sent it back to the radio station. So I wound up calling opening day 2012 with my cell phone, which was a flip phone at that point, duct taped to the top of a Mountain Dew, like liter Mountain Dew bottle. I had made a mic stand out of it and called the game into the flip phone taped to that bottle. And you're right, that's not that long ago. That was 12 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I mean, no notes. I have nothing further to add other than to say, that is an amazing story, Joe Davis. We are thrilled for you and really appreciate your time, giving us some stories, giving us some perspective. You don't need to plug your work, because people just turn the TV on. Joe's probably talking over some sport.
Sorry.
I wasn't even trying to listen to Joe Davis, and there I was watching Vikings Cardinals on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, you sound like my wife. Right. You're just always talking.
Like, oh, there he goes. How can I turn? She doesn't have a choice. She doesn't get to change the channels. Yep. Joe Davis, this was a delight. Thank you so much. And let's work on that stadium, all right?
Hey, I don't know if we can repair that. I think it's beyond. I feel bad for soccer.
Thank you, Joe.
Hey, guys.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Thank you to Joe Davis for joining us. The other night, I went to a bar in New York. to play some billiards with a couple of buddies of mine, and there was a movie on at the bar, The Man with the Golden Gun, the 1974 Bond movie featuring bad guy, I think his name is Scaramanga, Francisco Scaramanga. And as I watched The Man with the Golden Gun, I thought to myself, you know what would make this better? The Man with the Golden At Bat.
You think they had, how do you think this idea would have been received in the 70s?
Way worse.
Probably not. Not well. All right, friends, let's talk about it. If you've been online for the last 4 days, we were probably a little bit late to the party. But we're going to talk about it. Before we get to the good, the bad, the ugly, how we love to finish our final show of the week, I propose we just do this for bad, but let's talk about it separately. Jason Stark wrote a very lengthy story for The Athletic, contemplating an idea that Rob Manfred did say out loud, although I would say that how this has been characterized in headlines has been completely irresponsible and ridiculous. But Rob Manfred did say on a podcast that the idea of a golden at-bat, which is the concept in the most basic form that once a game, a team could have the opportunity to send up any hitter in their lineup at any point to hit in place of another hitter. That is an idea that has in some form been discussed as a injection of drama, of life, of consequence, of tension, because baseball is craving replicating the greatest at-bats that we have in our sport, whether it is a Juan Soto at-bat in the highest leverage moment of the game, whether it is a Mike Trout versus Shohei Ohtani in the WBC. Why can't we just have that all the time? Look at the other sports. And let's start with that last point, because that is a large part of Jason Stark's article, Jake. And I love Jason. I respect Jason. I appreciate Jason very much. However, I do not care to get into the logistical details of why this would not work or why this would be messy, because I reject the premise so fervently and am honestly insulted by the premise so fervently that I don't even care to be like, well, what would happen if the guy has to bat two times in a row? No. We don't have to have that conversation here, okay? Those are other sports. This is baseball. That's fine. Baseball's doing pretty good. And if we were going to completely fundamentally change, this is another thing. Oh, well, look at all these changes, these rule changes. The things that have happened in baseball recently to change the sport, they have improved the sport. They have not changed the sport. This would change the sport. It would be a different sport, and it would not be something that I think would actually give us anywhere close to what is being dreamt about in these so-called, in these owners meetings where there is quote-unquote buzz about this idea. That is my opening statement. Jake Mintz, how do you feel?
This is a bad idea for all the reasons that you just said. It is a bad idea. However, the way that the baseball internet world has responded to this idea is somewhat disheartening to me. Why do we know about this idea? Let's just think about it, right? Why did Rob Manfred say this out loud? Because he's floating it. He's floating it to us, and then we're saying this is stupid, and he's taking it back, right? That being said, I want the people running baseball to be creative with ways to push the sport forward. Is this a way to do it? Absolutely not. No, bad. Two thumbs down, anti-golden at bat. I think we would have felt this way about the pitch clock in 2008. And I think you are correct that the golden at bat does fundamentally change the sport in a way that the pitch clock doesn't. But maybe there's a version of this in some form or fashion that it doesn't fundamentally change the sport, but enhances the experience. Like, in my opinion, the pitch clock does. And so even though this idea stinks, I want to encourage everybody to maintain an open mind about other ideas that might not stink. If we keep the sport static as it is right now, we'll be cooked in 70 years. You need to keep adapting and changing and adjusting to the times. Baseball has done that in the last handful of years with these rule changes. They will have to continue to do that as we move forward. Don't forget that. Golden at bat, bad idea.
I mean, we could go a lot longer on this. I think a lot of very smart things have been written. A lot of very funny things have been written, but a lot of very smart things. I think what Russell Carlson wrote for Baseball Prospectus was so good because it basically talked about what you're trying to achieve, which is, oh, the best hitters batting Trout against the best pitchers at the end of the game. Yeah, that doesn't actually, that wouldn't actually happen that much. And if you actually implemented this rule, the teams would respond to it the way they respond to every rule. How can we actually maximize this? Which in a lot of cases might just be putting up your best guy in the fourth inning down by one. That's not like, that might be the answer, which that's not Ohtani Trout, right? And also that's just not baseball, as I already said. And so the desired effect, just thinking about how often this would actually become into play in a relevant way, is also maybe not there on top of all the obvious other points that you would be completely transforming what is an actual team game where everybody is motivated to contribute so that you could get back to the good players. To me, that's part of the fun, right? When you're watching a game and the bottom of the lineup comes up, you're like, just got to get it back to the top. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. But the payoff is great if you do actually get it when the stars do align. Like, that's baseball. That's really cool. And because we have so many games, it's not like we never see Aaron Judge batting in the ninth inning. That still happens quite often. And so I don't feel like this doesn't feel like we're addressing actual problem. We're just chasing something that I don't think we would actually be achieved. That's my main issue.
I like how MLB has sought to break up the season with various bizarre milestones, like the game in the NASCAR track. I would be interested to see if there are certain games throughout the year that have different rules. Now, obviously, that would create a really uneven playing field, but it is something that I am more open to. Like, if you wanted to have one game a year where you could do this, I'm more willing to, like, consider that, right? And I think they are totally fine if they want to test this rule out in the Atlantic League laboratory, like, go bonkers. But as far as a long-term idea in Major League Baseball, I am definitely against it. Now it is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, and one thing bizarre, wonky, abnormal from the week that was. And I will begin with my good, which is casual outfits at press conferences. Kyle Higashioka, the infamous home run stroker, and Blake Snell both consummated their deals this week. Very different dollar figures. Higashioka signing for 2 years and $13.5 million. Blake Snell for 6 years and $182 million. However, both rolled up in what I can only describe as Friday casual. Higashioka in a fluffy tan jacket and a black button-down shirt that you would wear to, like, a Shabbat dinner is how I would describe this. Certainly not fancy. And then Snell taking it one step further with just, like, a dark teal sweater. Like a crew neck sweater. Look, one could make the argument that on this very important day, you should dress up. And I think if I was signing a contract, I would dress nicely, nicer than this. That does not need to be the expectation. And I think it is good that Blake Snell, of all people, is the one to push this issue. He's not someone who really wears suits. And so why would he be something he's not when he is introducing himself to the Dodger faithful? And for that reason, it is good people being authentic with their outfit options.
I agree. That said, Juan Soto, show up to the winter meetings in pajamas to sign your $701 million contract. I need it. All right. My good this week. Yes, a onesie. Is Eugenio Suarez winning the Venezuelan Winter League Home Run Derby, a star-studded affair that included Jose Altuve, who continues to participate in these, even though he always hits like one and then just waves to the crowd and goes home. We love Altuve, but we had William Contreras in this. We had Jackson Churio, who lost in the finals to Suarez. But I just love Suarez being in this because this is not just a celebrity cameo for him. He's playing in the league. He hit two homers in his first game last week because, again, he's still one of the best third basemen in the league. And Venezuelan Winter League is not particularly, you know, pitcher friendly. And I just love Gino so much. He's one of my favorite active players. And it was just another reminder that he is one of the great home run hitters of his generation. I mean, he's going to get to 300 home runs this upcoming season if he stays healthy, most likely. And that is a hell of an achievement for that guy. So I love Gino. I like seeing him win things. So that is my good.
That's a good pick. My bad is a Jonathan Papelbon quote. Jonathan Papelbon went on the Baseball Isn't Boring podcast hosted by Rob Bradford, who we love. Shouts out to Rob. Papelbon was discussing his Hall of Fame ballot, which unsurprisingly included Dustin Pedroia. I can't believe it. His argument for putting Dustin Pedroia on his Hall of Fame ballot that doesn't actually count, like he doesn't vote, is not war, but bar. Balls above replacement. That's all I got for you.
So that's no notes. That's all right. Welcome in, Petey. You're on your way to Cooperstown.
We can't be voting for the Hall of Fame based upon who has the biggest balls. Like, come on, dude. I understand that maybe war is not the best method for encapsulating a player's career. There is more than that, but yeah, we don't need to measure it in nut size.
No, but here's the thing. Papelbon came up with this line and he was like, oh, this is a banger. This is going to hit so hard when I unleash this on this podcast. And I haven't seen the clip of him saying this, but I imagine he looks like pretty proud. He's like, this is what we're doing here. This is what we're doing. Yeah. That's great. Jonathan Papelbon, to be clear, does not have a vote in the Hall of Fame, but that's, you know, if Jonathan Papelbon would like to join the BBWAA and then stick around for 10 years, then he could vote. Although Pedroia will be off the ballot by then. My bad this week is a tweet from @MLB. I don't know if you saw this, Jake, but we had, you know, the whole Spotify rap situation. And so you have a lot of teams and brands kind of posting rapped adjacent things. And you've posted a good meme. You're in that mix. MLB posted a list, which I believe is accurate. I don't believe they just pulled this out of nowhere. These were the top mentioned teams of 2024. Okay. So my understanding of this is these are the teams that have been tagged the most or added the most on Twitter or whatever we want to call our terrible website at this point. 10 teams, Jake. Dodgers, Yankees, Mets, Red Sox, Padres, Phillies, Blue Jays, Braves, Orioles. All of those make some amount of sense, right? Good teams, bad teams, teams in Canada that have a lot of people following them. Number 10, the A's. Here's why this is bad, Jake. What can you not do if you go to the Athletics timeline? You cannot reply. It literally is not an option. Now, that doesn't mean I can't start a new tweet and mention them. But the fact that the A's have had their replies turned off for the entire season and still were number 10 on this list, and that MLB was willing to post it, I don't know. Is that bad? It's just, for something about it is like screams to how angry people are and are going out of their way to tweet. Because again, you cannot reply to the A's. It's so funny that they still ended up being number 10. And also they have probably, I think, and I'm sure this number has gone down, not just because everybody is exiling the website, but because everyone's mad at the A's. They also have, you know, one of the lowest follower counts of any team in the league, right? So much about it is just amazing that they would be the 10th most mentioned team this season.
If the A's account had replies on like everybody else, they would be top five on this list. Easy. Right. What's funny to me is that in the graphic, it says 2024 top mentioned teams, and it only shows the top five teams in the graphic, but yet the tweet has the top 10. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating that MLB was like, well, we got to do the top 10 in the text so that the A's make the list. Just tweet the top five. None of us talking about you looking like a dodo on the podcast.
Right. Oh, man. So I thought that was very funny. All right. What's your Ugla?
The winter meetings is just around the corner. We are headed to Dallas, Texas on Sunday to participate in the annual baseball jamboree. And when people in my life ask me, what is the winter meetings? Because boy, it really is just an inside baseball thing. I describe it as the annual baseball convention, which it practically is. And I'm working on something right now about the history of the winter meetings. And do you know when the first winter meetings were? What year?
I think it was the 50s. Was it earlier than that?
This is from Wikipedia. The tradition of baseball holding off-season meetings during December dates back to 1876. The winter meetings are older than most of the teams. Most of the teams are younger than the winter meetings. During that first winter meetings, this is from an article by our friend Steph Abstein at Sports Illustrated. Two teams, the New York Mutuals and Philadelphia Athletics, were expelled from the National League for failing to play all their scheduled games. Look how far we have come for the winter meetings. They are weird. They are wonky. They are at times pointless. They are at times very, very important to meet people, to shake hands, to kiss babies, to make connections. They are different than what they used to be back in the day when we didn't have cell phones and text messages. Like, this is when all the trades would happen in one very specific window. Obviously, with modern communication, that's no longer the case. But it is nice to just see all these faces in one place and to see Hall of Famers throwing down beers in the lobby and to, you know, gawk at GMs strolling in their quarter zips through the halls. I cannot wait for it, and I'm excited to see you.
Yeah, and I think it is just such an unpredictable event. Last year was a total dud in terms of action. The year before was a lot of fun. We had a lot going on at the winter meetings in San Diego 2 years ago, and we'll see if Soto and whatever comes after Soto will make this year in Dallas a little bit more interesting. The venue also often plays a big part in it, and we have not been to this hotel in Dallas, so I'm curious how much that impacts, you know, what you get to see and how often you get to see people strolling through these gigantic hotel lobbies. My Ugla this week, Jake, as we wrap up, is that Fernando Rodney is going to pitch in Canada. He has signed a deal with the Intercounty Baseball League's Hamilton Cardinals. And this is amazing because related to your bad, Fernando Rodney is currently on the Hall of Fame ballot. And I am just imagining a situation where Fernando Rodney goes to the Intercounty Baseball League in Canada, which is an incredible league. And I encourage everybody looking into the history of this league because it is, speaking of, been around for a long time. My gosh. If he just goes and is like throwing 98 and somehow someone goes to see like the Blue Jays who need relief help are like, well, we might as well just go down the road and see what Fernando Rodney looks like right now. And he gets signed. What happens to his Hall of Fame eligibility? Does it reset? And then he would show back up on the ballot in 20, 30? Like, again, we're jumping a lot ahead here, but I just love somebody still actively playing while on the Hall of Fame ballot, even if it is not an MLB. I love that for Fernando Rodney. He turns 48 in March. He is an absolute baseball legend, and I wish him the best as he pitches against a bunch of Canadian former college players.
Do you know the name of the head coach of the Hamilton Cardinals?
The head coach? I don't. Is that what they call them in the IBL? I don't know. Or is it still a manager?
Chris Piano.
Spelled piano? There's no...
Chris Piano. Fernando Rodney is going to play for the Hamilton Cardinals in the Intercontinental Baseball League to play for skipper Chris Piano.
And Piano is going to walk on out to the mound. He's signaling down to the bullpen. And here comes Fernando Rodney, the best closer in all of Southern Ontario. That's our show. Do you have anything else on Chris Piano?
I just want to know if he's going to press all the right keys here tonight.
All right. I'm going to go look up about Chris Piano. Thank you all so much for listening to Baseball Barbercast. Thank you to Joe Davis for joining us. A delightful conversation that was. Hopefully you all enjoyed it. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And we will next talk to you in Dallas, Texas. Or will we talk to you sooner? Who's to say? It all depends on Juan Soto. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz, for making this show possible. And we will talk to you all again very soon. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on these mics in no time.
Keys to the Game, brought to you by Chris Piano.